It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
FBI Confidential, taking you inside the FBI with hosts Debbie Dujanovic, Cheryl Worsley, and Becky Bruce.
Welcome. Today I'm joined by a special agent whom we are not going to reveal his identity, and that's because we are talking about SWAT today. And he actively works cases, and we would not want to do anything to endanger him. So thank you for joining us today. You do train active shooters, and that's our topic today, is active shooter situation. So you train the other agents on active shooters.
Yeah, how to respond to active shooters.
So what goes into that training?
So there's quite a bit that goes into it. We have, the FBI has supported a group called ALERT, which is down in San Marcos, Texas. Stands for Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training. And they put on a week-long course called Train the Trainers. And in that course, they're teaching law enforcement officers how to respond to active shooter situations. They have a lot of actual live scenarios and live role players, and they go through a number of scenarios.
So you're training not just special agents with the FBI, you're training police and all kinds of law enforcement, is that right?
Correct. We'll train law enforcement to train other law enforcement. We'll train special agents to train other law enforcement as well.
So we've just had this shooting in Parkland, Florida. It's just been a couple of weeks ago. And what is it that you tell people?
Yeah, so for the civilian response, what we advocate is run, hide, fight. And that's something the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, all the federal agencies are on board with that response. And it's pretty self-explanatory. If you are able to run and get out of the building, you want to do that. You want to get away from the situation. If you're unable to safely flee or run away from the active shooter, then you want to try to hide or barricade yourself. Finally, the last case is if the active shooter finds you, you want to fight. You want to fight back and try to disarm the active shooter.
As you're running, if you see someone injured as a civilian, should you try to get them out?
Yes, absolutely. If you are able to safely get them out, you should try to do that. If it's going to put you in jeopardy and you're both going to get shot, then we advocate that you try to get yourself out.
I know this because I took the FBI's Citizens Academy training, but you might see, if you're in an active shooter situation and you're running out, you might see SWAT members running in and not helping injured. Can you explain to me why?
Yeah, so that is difficult to do, even in training, right? We'll train that scenario where we have SWAT officers responding to an active shooter event. As they enter a building, we'll have people mocked up so they look like they've been injured and crying out to the SWAT operators. We need to eliminate the threat first and stop the killing, and then we can go back and assist those who are injured.
So if you can't get out, you're supposed to hide. What goes into that?
You know, you can hide. Depends on what sort of building you're in, environment you're in. If you are in a classroom, hopefully you can lock the door. You can barricade that door with chairs, with desks, anything that might be available. And just try to make it as difficult as possible for that active shooter to find you.
What about cell phones? Can they be a hindrance or help? Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, sure. So they could reveal your location. A lot of the times, these active shooter events, they don't go on too long. I think the average is about 5 minutes. Most of them are over in 5 minutes, right? But once the active shooting starts, a lot of people will call 911. They'll call their family and friends. And so pretty soon all the phones start ringing. You can imagine the students in the Parkland High School. As soon as that word went out that there was an active shooter event at that school, I'm sure many cell phones were going off or ringing and that sort of thing. So you can silence your cell phone, and that way that won't reveal your location. But on the positive side, a cell phone can be very helpful for responding officers and law enforcement. You can tell us where the shooter is, if he's in the cafeteria, how many shooters there are. All that information is very helpful.
Should that be done on social? How should that be done?
Well, that's a good question. I think if you can call 911, that's a good way to do it. Often 911 gets overloaded, but that's the system set up and put in place to pass information to law enforcement.
Okay. But if not, or if 911 is overloaded, is it all right to go on Twitter and talk about what's happening?
I think so.
You think so? That's okay, even though shooter may be monitoring Twitter, possibly.
True. Yeah, so you have to be careful about that. I wouldn't put, hey, we're hiding in, you know, classroom 234.
Right.
I wouldn't put that out on social media.
You mentioned SWAT goes right in. That changed after Columbine. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, so I mentioned SWAT because I run the SWAT team. Law enforcement prior to Columbine, and at Columbine, law enforcement officers would wait for SWAT to arrive. Well, typically SWAT's going to be 20, 30, 40 minutes behind. And like I mentioned, most of these incidents are over within 5 minutes. So what ALERT is advocating now, what the FBI is putting forward now, is officers have to respond immediately. At Columbine, that was not the protocol. Patrol officers responded, and they waited. They waited for SWAT to arrive. It was over. I think it took 40 minutes for the SWAT team to arrive in Columbine. By that point, the shooters had killed themselves, and all the killing was done by that point. So now we're advocating and really encouraging those officers. Even if it's just one officer that shows up, he's got to go. He's got to go in. He or she has to go in and respond and try to stop that killing.
That's likely why the deputy at Parkland who didn't go in is under severe scrutiny right now, because the protocol has indeed changed since then.
Correct. And I feel for that guy. I mean, you know, it's very difficult. I was reading some of the statistics before coming in today, and if one officer responds to and is engaged, or rather engages the shooter, a third of those officers are shot. So that's a huge risk that those guys are taking. You know, you got to do it. You got to go in and stop that killing, because innocent people are getting killed, but they are taking a huge risk. And I think it's important that the public recognizes that.
That's a huge risk. I guess that's what they sign up for every day, though. So
correct.
Yeah. Do you feel that teachers and students need to train with Run, Hide, Fight?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, most importantly, the school district and the schools should have a plan in place and know what their protocol is going to be, what are they going to do, and they need to practice that, because you can have the best plan in place, but if you don't practice it, it's not going to happen when the shooting starts. So very important to rehearse those plans and practice those plans. And again, we're advocating for the Run, Hide, Fight.
We talked a little bit about run. We talked a little bit about hide. What about fight? Fight is probably the most intimidating one of those three. But what do you do?
So it's when you have multiple civilians attacking an active shooter, they're going to take him down. Somebody might get shot in that process, but they're gonna win if they're aggressive and they're working together. If it's just one unarmed civilian against the active shooter, well, you might lose that battle. But if guys and girls gang up on that active shooter, they're going to win that battle, and they can overtake them.
Gang up how?
You can use any weapons that might be lying around. Chairs are a good thing to throw at somebody. Fire extinguishers can knock somebody out pretty easily. Just even standing behind the door when they open it, slamming the door shut on them, could potentially knock the weapon out of their hands. So there's a number of things that you can do to fight back.
I'm looking at this room. There's a couple of file cabinets that I could put in front of the door. I don't see anything but chairs that I might use as weapons. Maybe one of those speakers, if I could get it down. Is this something that you need to go through in your head ahead of time, or do you just use what's around you in the moment?
It's good to be thoughtful about it and proactive. So prior to something like this occurring, go through those scenarios and you're going to respond much better.
We talked a little bit about what to do when you get in those situations. Let's talk now about what you do as a SWAT team member. And could you tell me a case where you had a close call?
Yeah, sure. So with SWAT, we're in a much better position than the average patrol officer out there. He's pulling over. Again, he or she is pulling over a car. They don't know what they're getting into. They don't know who's in that car. They don't know if they're wanted. If they get arrested and they're going to jail for life, that officer doesn't know that. So they're in a very dangerous position, and they're reacting. With the SWAT team and the FBI in particular, our investigations are long-term. Typically, we know everything about the subject that we're going to go and arrest. So we pick the time and the place to arrest that individual. And a lot of thought goes into that, trying to determine what's going to be the safest way to do that. We try to avoid car stops and car chases. So a lot of time we'll go to their house, and sometimes we'll know that there are kids in the house, so we have to adjust our tactics for that. One particular case, I think it was up in Missoula, Montana, we had our main subject was on the main floor of the residence. And then, excuse me, there was a basement to this as well. It was a basement apartment. That person was unassociated with the individual that we were arresting. We surround the house, and now the SWAT tactics have changed quite a bit in the past 5 years. Rather than rush in and rush through the house and look for the subject, we will breach a door and we'll call the person to us. So we were doing that, and in the midst of doing all that, the individual in the downstairs apartment came out into the living room, and we had some windows, daylight windows that we were looking through. The person came out with a cell phone in their hand, but it was not well lit. So it was hard to tell what he had in his hand, and we were giving commands to this individual. They weren't responding. So they were non-compliant. They had something in their hand. And so it was a little bit tense situation, but the fact that we were outside the house looking through the window provided us a little bit of protection. The fact that we knew this person was not supposed to be associated with the main subjects upstairs, all of that kind of helped us to be patient and continue issuing commands. Eventually, we realized it was a cell phone in his hand.
So he didn't get shot.
So he didn't get shot, right?
Wow.
So careful planning, having the ability to pick the time and place of choosing and doing it in a safe location really helps to keep everybody safe.
Is that why the protocol changed from breaking down the door and rushing in? Talk about that. Why did it change?
Yeah, that was... That's part of the reason it changed. We'll knock and announce, and then if they don't come to the door, we knock the door down, we run into the house. This was the previous standard, and we'd run into the house and try to find that subject before they could get to a gun. That was a thought, right?
Right.
Well, it takes a long time to knock and announce, wait a reasonable amount of time for them to answer the door. Probably they know you're there since you've knocked and announced.
Right.
That's the intent anyway. So now you're running into the house. If they wanted to get a gun, they probably had time to get a gun. And so we would see shootings on occasion because of that. Now we'll wait outside, knock and announce. If they don't come to the door, we breach the door. We're continuing to call and call them out. And most of them will comply. They realize, you know what, there's nowhere I can run. So typically they come out.
You breach the door, that gives you opportunity to deploy other tactics.
Correct.
Like tear gas or smoke.
Correct. And we have a little robot that we'll send in, and the robot has a camera on it. So we can run that in and then see, okay, maybe the subject's in the back bedroom. So now when we know he's in the back bedroom, we can call out to him, say, hey, we see you. It's harder for a subject to ignore you when you know exactly where he is.
Mm-hmm. And all of that should try to decrease the likelihood of injury or casualty to both the SWAT officers and to the people who might be in the building.
Correct. Absolutely.
Have you ever had a situation where there were kids involved and that threw you off?
We've had pretty good intelligence on. So I've been here in Salt Lake for about 2.5 years. And I think in that time we've done probably about 30 SWAT ops. And we've had pretty good intelligence on those. Maybe a quarter of them, there were kids in the house. And sometimes we know that they're in this bedroom in the back corner. Other times we don't know where in the house they are. I have had the occasion, I'm not here in Salt Lake, but other places where we didn't know there were kids in the house, and we breached the front door, and the kids were right there in the living room. And that can be very dangerous because a lot of time we'll throw a flashbang, which is a diversionary device. One of our tactics is before you throw that flashbang, you look to see where you're throwing it, where it's going to land.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that case, we breach the front door. They look, they see the kids. They don't throw the flashbang, fortunately, because that can be very dangerous,
right.
As you can imagine.
So you adapt in those situations. What do you do after you know there are innocents inside?
Yeah, then that becomes, all right, well, do we get them out first, or do we hold them where they are and get the main subject out first? Just recently in Helena, we had that situation, and there are 2 kids, 6 and 3, in one bedroom. We just held them in that bedroom while we got the main subject out, and then we dealt with them.
Okay, so you try to get the innocence out, so the kids or, you know, a spouse or somebody who may not be connected, you try to get them out.
Correct.
What if the suspect is holding them hostage?
Yeah, so that complicates things dramatically, and that the risk level escalates substantially when it's a hostage situation. And in that instance, if we know that somebody, you know, might be prone to taking their girlfriend hostage, then rather than give them a ton of time to think about that and hold outside, then we might go back, revert to the older tactics where you run in, get in there, and get between the main subject and the potential hostage.
So the protocol will change based on the situation.
Correct. Okay. Absolutely.
How often do you train?
So we train 4 days a month, and most of the agents on the SWAT team are case agents first. So they're working violent crime, they're working white-collar crime, public corruption, cyber, you know, a myriad of different, all the violations that the FBI works. They're doing that full-time, more or less, and then SWAT is an auxiliary duty.
So I think you mentioned you did 30 cases in about 2 years. Is about 15, 20 about an average year for you?
Yep, that seems to be about average, yeah.
And are these all federal cases? Are you involved sometimes in local law enforcement cases?
So all those were federal cases. We do assist locals if they need our assistance. So here in Salt Lake, we have an armored vehicle. Not all the police departments do. So on occasion, we will bring that vehicle to one of their SWAT operations and assist them with that. The larger municipalities, their SWAT teams are very capable. In some of the smaller communities, they have smaller SWAT teams or they don't have a SWAT team. So in that case, if the FBI is working a case jointly with the locals, a lot of the time our SWAT team will go and assist.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. Can you talk about your most memorable case, and I'm hoping that you can. If so, why was it the most memorable case?
Sure. Yeah, so one highlight of my career so far, really, has been a hostage rescue that we did down in Dothan, Alabama. And in this case, there was an elderly man. Well, I say elderly. He was 65, I think. And he had dug a bunker on his property, and he took a six-year-old kid and took them hostage and held them down in that bunker for about a week. And he was holding that kid. He wanted to get a reporter down there and talk about his what he saw as all the injustice in the world. Eventually, on the sixth day, the situation was kind of unraveling. We felt he was going to kill the kid. And so we launched a rescue attempt, and it was extremely difficult, and he ended up shooting up out of the hole as we were trying to make entry, and it was pretty traumatic, but ultimately we saved the kid, and the main subject was killed in the process, and none of the operators were hurt. So that was just a phenomenal experience.
So you felt, I'm assuming that was very rewarding to see that positive outcome on something that could have gone so badly.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely.
So you have, I assume, specialists on SWAT. So you have a sniper, probably. You have those who are versed in explosives, both for disarming and for flashbangs and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the training that has to go into that? Is that also 4 days a month, or is it more specific than that?
Sure. So you're correct. We've got a number of snipers. They have to do additional training to become snipers, and then sustainment training as well. And they're really good on rural ops in particular. Urban ops, we don't use them quite as much. But they're also what we call operators. So if it's not a sniper-specific mission, then they're rolling right into the stack and making entry with the rest of the guys. FBI also has Special Agent Bomb Techs. They've had that program for a long time. They work very closely with the state and local authorities and bomb techs. And recently they've got a pretty neat program that they're pushing out, and it's called the Tactical Bomb Tech Program. And the intent, or the purpose of the tactical bomb techs, is during these active shooter situations, we're seeing more cases of IEDs, explosive devices, and potentially hostages that are holding an explosive device or sitting on an explosive device. And so we need to have a bomb tech integrated with the SWAT team that can deal with those situations. So bomb techs in the FBI can elect to go to additional training, and it's quite a bit of additional training that they go to, and they get more equipment, specialized equipment to deal with IEDs, and they learn how to deal with that stuff. And it's pretty fascinating to watch because they do a great job in a really high-stress situation.
I imagine there's a lot that goes into that.
Yeah.
You mentioned a second ago a positive outcome, and we know that not all of the outcomes are positive. And you know, these are real people who are working SWAT and are dealing with high stress outcomes that aren't always good. So how do you take care of yourself? How do SWAT members deal with some of that negativity?
Yeah, I think there is probably a lot of stress that goes into the job. And I'm the only full-time guy, so it's a little bit easier for me. The guys on the team that are working cases, it can be very difficult to be gone for a SWAT op. And we have a huge division, so they might be driving 12 hours. You get up bright and early in the morning, you do your SWAT operation, hopefully everything goes well, and then they're driving back home another 10 hours. They get back, get up in the next morning, they got casework that has fallen behind that they got to catch up on. Mm-hmm. So it can be very difficult and very stressful, and they need the support of their supervisors to, you know, and for the most part, the FBI is pretty good about realizing these guys are really wearing two hats and carrying a lot, carrying a big load. But the camaraderie helps, and every now and then we will do some training, hike Angel's Landing at Mount Zion, something like that, and kind of some fun training.
Team building.
Exactly.
With the SWAT team. If you had one or two things that you would like the general public to know about the men and women, I'm presuming, who work SWAT, what would you want people to know about you?
I think that it's important for them to know we're trying to do this job as safely as possible. And like I said, a tremendous amount of work goes into planning these ops, figuring out the best time to do it, best way to do it, and we're trying to make a positive difference in their community. Sometimes we see that feedback from neighborhoods. Other times we don't. Some neighborhoods are very happy to see us. They're like, yes, we're so glad you came in and finally arrested this person. He's been causing problems, you know, for months, whatever. But it is important that the public understand we are trying to do it as safely as possible. And these guys work very hard to be at a skill level that enables them to do that safely.
Do you sense a backlash among some communities with regards to concerns over police brutality? Is that rubbing off?
That does worry me a little bit. A lot of there's two sides to every story, and a lot of the time, because somebody that might have been involved in a shooting, the police, they are under investigation. So the police department can't really reveal their side of the story because it's under investigation, because they're going to go to trial, that sort of thing. And so a lot of the time, the police officer is denigrated in the media or on social media, because that's the only side of the story that's out there. Now, I'm not saying all the police shootings are justified. You know, on occasion, there are mistakes made, grave mistakes made that need to be dealt with.
Okay. All right. You live in this community. You're part of this community. And so are the other members of SWAT. So looking to do what's good for the community.
Absolutely.
All right.
Doing our best.
Anything you would like to add?
No, I think that's about it.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me, Special
Excellent.
Agent.